Thank you. And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Bob Lemke from Glendale.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bob Lemke. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. I want to thank Joshua, who's not here. I'll make a note of that. And John for all the conversation we've had over the phone. It's always a pleasure for me to participate. I think it's a little more meaningful when we have some new people or comparatively new people. Because whether you new people realize this or not, and I'm sure you don't, because we didn't. Fact of life. Next to us old timers, you're the second most important. And don't ever forget it. But really, without you new people, this thing would probably end up with all us old timers sitting around here telling these same old stories. We'd probably all get drunk. I'm what the book says, a real alcoholic. In fact, I'm one of them bar drinking drunks. Are there any bar drinkers here tonight? Thank God. I mean, I don't know where the rest of you did your thing, but I'll tell you what, if you didn't get some bar time in, you missed a lot of fun. I loved everything about those joints, you know? I love everything that goes on in there. I like the smell in there. I like them stools you can spin around on. I like the mirrors they got in those places. John and I could go out here tomorrow, open up a joint without a mirror. Fact of life, we go broke in 2 weeks. Three things you have to have in this country in order to operate a bar successfully. One, you got to have the booze. Second, you have a license to sell it. And third, you got to have a mirror. Or you will not make it in the bar business. That mirror, incidentally, is not there for social drinkers. Bars cannot survive on social drinkers. They depend on people who drink in volume. And you and I are the volume drinkers of this world. Social drinkers do weird stuff in bars. You bar drinkers know what I'm talking about. They come in, have a couple drinky poos, and then they start saying weird off the wall kind of crap like, well, I'm getting dizzy, I'm going home. Going home? People like you and I, we sit there all day. And we have to have something to entertain ourselves, and it's usually our own image, thus the mirror. We sit there all day staring in the mirror, you know, figuring things out. I like the jukebox they got in those joints. You know, the ones that play Born to Lose all day. I even got to like the men's John, and when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, we used to have a guy around AA at that time by the name of Norm Alpe, who, in my opinion, is the greatest speaker Alcoholics Anonymous ever had, ever will have. And he's a bar drinking drunk, and the first time I heard him, is up at a podium, something similar to this, and he talked fast. I mean, he's the only guy up till tonight can give a 1 hour talk in 32 minutes, you know. He'd shoot it out there really fast, and you had to listen close to catch it. He's up there this night going on and on. All of a sudden, he said something weird. At least I thought it was. I'm pretty new. He said he got to be a bathroom slider in the men's John. And one of the bananas fell out of my ears. And what's this clown talking about, you know? I mean, I think I've done it all. And here's this guy talking about something completely. I don't know what the world he's talking about. And he went on to explain that bathroom sliders in the men's John, I think in the ladies too, where they have to pay toilets. Good, keen, smart alcoholics slide under the door to avoid paying. Save that money for drinking whiskey. I thought, my God, why didn't I think of that? I bet you there's a couple newcomers thinking that right this minute. And then he went on to explain whenever he got done doing what he was doing in there, he'd slide back out. Never realizing, of course, once you're in there, you can turn the handle and walk out. Anybody that thinks like that is a friend of mine. And so I am eternally grateful to the Norm Alpes and the Eddie Regans and the Chuck Chamberlains and the Jimmy Ryans who said things from podiums like this to drunks like me or I wouldn't be here. Yeah, they made sense. They talked about things that really I knew what they were talking about. And they come from all kinds of walks of life and I am eternally grateful. Are there any Texans here tonight? No Texans? That's rare. They move around a lot, you know. The reason I ask that is when you talk in Texas, if in the first 5 minutes you don't tell them your sobriety date, they automatically assume you don't have one. And so in deference to any Texans, you know, my sobriety date is the 13th of January, 1964, which means I got 48 years working on 49. And I didn't come here, newcomers, I didn't come here to get 48 years sober. I came here primarily to get a lot of people off my back, you know. I'm sure you understand that. Them damn bill collectors and that woman and those kids and that damn dog. If they'd all get off of my back, everything would have been all right, you know. But that's the way it really was. And then I heard these guys, when they started talking, they talked about, you know, where they were born and, you know, how they grew up and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's kind of relevant. We kind of identify with some of these things. I was born in a little town in Wisconsin. And the day I was born, I had two strikes against me right out of the chute, you know. First of all, my dad was assistant chief of police in that town. And it's a small town, and you all know how little towns are. Everybody knows everything about everybody. And if you don't believe me, go and sit in one of them little towns. I mean, they know everything that's going on. And some, they know if you're a good guy or a bad guy, and sometimes I'm good and sometimes I'm bad. But that's the way it was. And my dad was a 6'4", 240-pound cop, wore a uniform, carried a gun, scared the living bejesus out of you. And for the first 15 years of my life, I did everything that that turkey told me to do. Just out of fear, because I knew deep down inside, if he ever hit me, he'd kill me. He's a big moose and a tough cop, and I'm scared to death of him. I mean, little things. If he told me to run to the store, I literally ran to the store. I mean, I didn't slow down when I got out of sight, neither, and I'd run all the way back. If he told me to carry out the trash, I carried out everything that even looked like trash. If he told me to rake the leaves, or even rake the neighbor's leaves. And in Wisconsin, we have a lot of snow. And he taught me very early in life, if 5 flakes of snow fell on our sidewalk, it's my job to take it off there. And I did that religiously, out of fear, until this magical thing that happens to all human beings, everybody here today, everybody out there, about the age of 15, something happens to human beings. Medical science to this day haven't got it figured out. But you and I know that it happened. I don't know how it happened to you, but I think we all have it somewhat the same. I think it came floating on a cloud or something in my bedroom at night and went kaboom. And no bells or whistles went off, but I knew the next morning something was different. And I remember like it's yesterday. I got up that morning, got dressed, went downstairs, had breakfast, headed off to school, right? No big deal. Come home from school at noon, it's snowing. I know my job, right? But this thing had happened in the night. Like a change of attitude or something. You know? Like, my thinking then was, what will the neighbor say? A genius out there shoveling snow. You know, it's kind of demeaning, you know. And I just made up my mind that morning or that noon, I just won't do it no more. It looks bad, you know, for a big shot like me to be out there shoveling snow. And so I just took the snow shovel, set it up against the house and said to myself, to heck with him, I just won't do it no more. I don't care what he does. I just won't do it no more. Went in the kitchen, sat down at the kitchen table, and started to eat my lunch. Then I heard the squad car pull up in front. And I heard the car door slam. Then I heard the shovel out there on the sidewalk. I said, it's about time he does something around here. Have you ever had the feeling like you got to do it all? That's the way I felt. He came walking in the house that noon, took off that uniform cap and that big heavy Mackinaw they wear in the winter and that Sam Brown belt and that 45, laid it on the dining room table like he did every day. Came in the kitchen, sat down at the kitchen table right across from me. Then he threw me a curve. He didn't say a word. And if you've just been endowed with the smarts, that'll drive you nuts. Yeah, I'm just waiting for him to say something. I've been saving it up for 15 years, you know. And today's the day I'm going to let him have it. And I finished my lunch ahead of him and realized I had to get back to school. I can remember this like it happened today. Got up, walked around the kitchen table, had to go past him, out through the dining room, through the living room, out the front door, back to school. I can't explain this. I'm sure you understand it. I just knew deep down inside, I could not let a situation like this go by without saying something. And I stood right in front of him, looked him right in the eye, reached down inside, got one of them pearls of wisdom I'd just been endowed with, right? Looked him right in the eye, said the smartest thing I could think of. I said, "Is the snow heavy today?" Big mistake. He didn't say a word again. He just kind of turned around in a chair like this, came all the way from right field, direct hit. And I took off in the air, up against the dining room windows. And when I came to, I developed another bad attitude. I said to myself, and only to myself, "Nobody can hit me like that and get away with it. I'll get even with him, by God, if it kills me." But I'll tell you something else. Maybe 10 seconds before he hit me, and incidentally, the only time he ever hit me in my life, and I know to this minute, I had that one coming. He was the sun, moon, and stars in my life. And that's what I'm going to be when I get big, and all that kind of stuff. But in the quiet of my room at night, I used to plan his demise. Now, I understand today that's not proper thinking for a 15-year-old to be planning his father's demise. But that's the way it really was. And some of these things I'm about to tell you, I believe, have all had a direct effect on my attitude towards people, places, and things. By the time I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, my attitude towards people, places, and things got really messed up. About a year after that hitting incident, another big deal happened. Another cold winter day in Wisconsin. Snow piled up as high as those windows. And three of my buddies, we come walking home from school about 4 p.m. Got to the corner to turn down to my house. And there across the street, passed out in full uniform, dead drunk in a snowbank. And these supposed friends of mine started teasing me about my drunk dad, that drunk cop. And we went to Fist City right there. And I won. But I'll never forget the feelings and emotions I had that day. I realized then and there that he had disgraced that uniform he wore, disgraced that badge he wore, and lost the faith and trust of that community that he had pledged his life to protect and to serve. Big deal. About a year after that big deal, another big deal happened. At the age of 47, he died of chronic alcoholism. Didn't say that on his death certificate. He's a big shot in that town. It said heart disease. But those of us who knew him and loved him knew the booze had gotten the best of him. And I found out another fact of life, that doctors, yeah, doctors, lie on death certificates for certain people in certain towns, and they're still doing it today. Fact of life. About another year after that big deal, another big deal happened in my life. I was going with this gal. When I say we were going together, we started out in kindergarten together. Same kindergarten, same grade school, same high school, same Sunday school, same church. Right out of high school, we got married. It was a beautiful event, crossed white shotguns, everything. She never did like me to say that, you know. And sometimes I clean it up and say it happens in the best regulated families, right? And right after we got married, like all women, she started to demand things like furniture to sit on and curtains on the windows and all that stuff. And I don't have any money. And so I go down and see my dad's buddy, the chief of police, told the chief, "She wants all this stuff and I don't have any money." He said, "Go up to the sheriff's department tomorrow. I think they need help." Walked in the sheriff's department the next morning to pin the gold badge on me. And I got to be a drunk cop, just like my dad. And time doesn't permit me to tell you what can happen to a drunk cop, except stir up some old resentments, and God knows you probably don't need any more, especially when it comes to cops. bunch of cop haters here tonight. I can spot them a mile away. Two on the side over here, three in the back, two over there, three. That guy even raised his hand. He's got more guts than a slaughterhouse. But I want to tell you newcomers, I don't have a bunch of warrants in my pocket, and you don't have to start heading for the doors. They took that badge away from me a long time ago, and next to the night my wife died, it was probably the second worst thing in my life. Because my career in law enforcement came to an abrupt halt one night. A bunch of cops and our wives were going to have a party. And I don't know about you, but I just love parties. And especially a cop's party, because at cop's party, the booze is all free. And that's where drunks like me really shine. I don't know about any of you, but I just love free booze parties. And I'm not the kind of guy at a free booze party sitting back there in the corner sipping on drinks with a little pinky sticking out, you know. I'm back there in the kitchen where the supply is. With both hands. Getting all I can get while the getting's good in case they run out, you know. And I don't know how long we're at that party. And she sidled up next to me in the kitchen and says, "We're leaving." I said, "What are you talking about, woman? We just got here." At least it seemed like that to me. And she looked at me with them cold Al-Anon eyes. And said, "We're leaving." And I don't know to this day how she got the keys. Because I'm like you, you know, it's my car, I drive. I'm sure nobody here ever said that. So we left, and all the way home, she started bad-mouthing me again about my drinking. And, you know, started telling me these god-awful things I don't want to hear, like truth. All of us alkies, I believe, are born with a switch behind the right ear. When people are laying this heavy-duty crap on us, we just shut the switch off. And don't even hit the eardrum. Just chew right over the top. And I can't explain this, but on the way home that night, because it says in the book, you and I who are real alcoholics go through life with blinders on us, like they put on horses, and we don't see anything that way, and we don't see anything that way. It's our way or no way. We're very selfish individuals. And she's yakking away at me, telling me all these god-awful things, so I shut the switch off. And I can't tell you to this day what happened, but I think the switch went back on and the blinders fell off. But for the first time in our married life, I started hearing some heavy-duty stuff. I mean, she started saying things to me, how my drinking is affecting our entire life, she said. I said, "Now what are you talking about?" She said, "First of all, it's affecting our social life." I said, "Yeah, how's that?" She said, "We just had to leave that party back there for one reason and one reason only." I said, "Yeah, what's that?" She said, "Because of your dirty, filthy mouth." I'm sure nobody here believes that. And then she said, not only that, it's affecting every other aspect of our life. And I said, "Now what are you talking about?" She said, "It's affecting our home life, our family life, our kids' lives, our financial life, our sex life, everything about us. It's been affected by my drinking." Now I'm certain she flipped her lid or something. And we got in the house and she wouldn't shut up. So I reached for the only thing I know would shut her up, a 38. I said, "Woman, I've heard all I'm ever going to hear from you about my drinking. I'll blow your damn brains out." And she took off like a deer. Out the front door of that house, 6 blocks down the street, to the only place she knew she could get help, right? The sheriff's office that I work at. And I'd have got her, too, if she just slowed down. And you'd have a different speaker here tonight, too. I'd probably up there be walking the yard tonight and talking the talk and walking the walk. And so I'm eternally grateful to something. Call any damn thing you want to. But I'm eternally grateful to this second that I didn't pull that trigger that night. And I came out of that blackout standing in the middle of the squad room at the sheriff's department at 3 o'clock in the morning with a 38 in my hand, going to kill somebody. And all the guys are standing around the squad room, and they're talking about all the crap that happened last night. And here I come. And they start looking at me kind of funny. You know how your family, friends, loved ones, fellow workers look at you when you're drunker than a skunk? They kind of look down their nose at you like you're some kind of second-class citizen or something. And if any of you don't know what I'm talking about right this second, you do not belong here. Those people near and dear to us really look at us funny when we're drunker than a skunk. And they're all looking at me kind of funny. And then the boss, the elected sheriff of that county, comes in the squad room. He heard the ruckus in the squad room. And he and I are thick like this. And he looked at those guys coming off the late shift, and then he looked at me. And he started walking over towards me. And I thought he was going to come and give me a pat on the back and tell me what a good guy I've been, you know. And he turned his hand like this and says, "Bob, hand it over, the badge and the gun." And they took away that badge, that gun, and that uniform, and I had to go out there and face that world bare naked. That's too much for a normal person, much less a drunk like me. So at the age of 31, I did the most adult, mature thing I could think of. I ran away from home. If there's any runners here tonight, I want to talk to you outside after the meeting. But I'll tell you not. No matter where I go in this country or any other country, these rooms are full of runners, you know that? Running to something, running from something. And every runner who's ever come to Alcoholics Anonymous, including me, we all forgot one thing, and we all forgot the same identical thing. And that is, no matter where you're running to or running from, you forgot it, I forgot it. I had to bring me along, and you had to bring you along. And you is the problem, and me is the problem. And you can't make this thing alone, and I can't make this thing alone. But together we make it. That's what it talks in our book. One drunk talking to another, and it works. Works to the tune of over 3 million sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's good enough for me, man. And I consider myself a very fortunate member of this fellowship, because over the years I believe I've had the privilege, and I mean the privilege, to probably eyeball 50% of them, eyeball to eyeball. I believe that's an earned privilege that's not given. You earn the right to do this and suit up and show up and drive to San Diego on a Saturday afternoon or something. I'm not complaining. I'm just reporting. And I love to do it, as you can tell. I guess I better tell you about my last drunk, because I've been here long enough to say this with authority. If you can't remember your last drunk, you probably haven't had it yet. And I don't know about any of you, but I never want to forget what was going on in my life the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. My last drunk was no big deal. I didn't sit around and plan it for 3 weeks or something. It just happened. It was a Friday night, the 27th of December, 1963. Just finished eating dinner. Made a big announcement to that woman and those kids. Told him, "I'm going out and have a couple of beers with the guys, and I'll be back in 2 hours." And she started that yak, 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 you know? I'm sure some of these guys know what I'm talking about. And I said, "Listen, woman, I want to tell you something for the last time. I just put in 40 for a bunch of ingrates around here. And I'm going out and commiserate with my buddies, and I'll be back in 2 hours. Now knock it off." And that was the 27th of December, 1963. And I got back on the 13th of January, 1964. Can't tell you to this day what the hell happened. I know on the 27th of December, 1963, I went to my favorite watering hole, a place called the Prelude. Now, isn't that a nice name for a dump? The Prelude on Lancashire Boulevard in North Hollywood, which really didn't have a lot to shoot for. It was one of them padded sewers I started to frequent. You know the kind I'm talking about? It didn't even have a front door, you know, just curtains hanging there. And I really went there to meet these lifelong drinking buddies of mine who I just met 2 weeks ago, right? And sure enough, they were all there. And we started doing the things real drunks do in bars. They're doing it right now in San Diego, the same identical thing. They're standing around talking in millions and spending in dimes. Trying to impress people we don't know with money we don't have. If you're a smart drunk like me, you're trying to hit on one of them beautiful dollies down there at the end of the bar, you know. Impress the heck out of them. You know. Didn't take long to do that. And then this, you know, there's six of us there, and one of them, his name was Pete. And Pete was one of them intellectual giants you meet in bars. You bar drinkers know what I'm talking about. That's the guy or gal who sits down there at the end of the bar and has the answers to every living subject in the world. And they drive people like you and I nuts. And that was Pete. I mean, if you had marital problems, and I had marital problems, he had the answers. If you had medical problems, he had the answers. If you had legal problems, he had the answers. If you had engineering problems, he had the answers. I thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. I thought, how can one guy know so much about so many things? And he can... I mean, Pete was one of those guys. He could find a jug on election day in a dry state, you know, one of them great guys. And besides that, he had A-negative blood. And I stuck pretty close to him. You know, before I hit the parking lot out here tonight, three people are going to tap me on the shoulder, ask me the same damn question the world over. They all say, hey, man, what do you mean by that A-negative blood crap? And just so we don't plug up the parking lot here tonight, I'll tell you ahead of time. First of all, if you have A-negative blood, it's rare blood. And when you're selling it to buy a wine, you get more for A-negative than any other kind of blood. So I stuck close to Pete, right? I mean, I might have been born at night, but not last night. And I can't tell you the serious events that happened, but we were living in these abandoned cars, one of which was mine. You laugh. You know how your car becomes an abandoned car? It's a kind of a big deal. The tires are usually flat. The battery is dead. It's out of gas, and it's usually 6 months behind in payments. Then legally, it becomes an abandoned car. I never knew that. It also got to be our living room, our kitchen, our bedroom, and our bathroom. Got a little salty in there. And I can't tell you the serious events that happened because I was passing in and passing out all the time. But I'll never forget one of those mornings I woke and I heard this music. It was like the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra was in the car with us. And I thought, man, this is how it must be just before you check out. And then I got scared. And I thought, you know, cops aren't supposed to get scared. But I got scared. And for the first time, I asked God for some help. Because the next morning, my friend Pete swallowed his tongue in the middle of the night in an alcoholic convulsion. And he's deader than a doornail. And I got fighting mad at everything, everybody. And God, if there is a God. Because my great intellect and better judgment told me, which incidentally got each and every one of you here tonight, our great intellect and better judgment gets us here. And my great intellect and better judgment told me that, you know, if there's a God, why would he let a good guy like Pete go, who knows everything there is to know about everything, and let me stay? And I can't tell you the serious, but I got down on my knees that day and cried out to this God I wasn't even sure of. Any prayer I know has helped me. And through a series of unexplained happenings, which I believe are miracles, because I got home that day, and my wife happened to be home for lunch that day, and I was telling her about this incident, and she said, isn't that funny? I said, well, not funny. And she said, I mean what happened to me. I said, what happened to you? She said, I was sitting at my desk at Warner Brothers yesterday, and you've been gone a long time. And I start crying at my desk. And all of a sudden, this guy with a big, tall guy with a fancy suit on come walking through the secretary pool. Don't tell me there's no miracles. stopped at her desk, tapped her on the shoulder, and says, "You better do that in here." Took her in his office, and for the first time in her career at the studios, she let it all hang out about this drunk she's married to and the father of her children. And he said, when she got all done, laying it all out, he said, "Why don't you have them try Alcoholics Anonymous?" And she said, "How do you know?" And he said, "'Cause I are one." And you know what? That was the first time in 37 years at the studios he broke his anonymity that morning to help one sick drunk, me. And thank God, I had the privilege many times to thank Matt Gilligan. God rest his soul. And I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and she went along to make damn sure I got there. And I went home from my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with sore ribs all night long. Did you hear that? Did you hear that? God rest her soul. Because on the 20th of November, 2001, she was diagnosed with melanoma cancer. And on the 21st of December, 2001, God came and took her. 3 weeks short of 54 years of marriage. And man, my life changed. My life changed. And any of you drunks that are married to women, if you hadn't said it, you better tell it. It's a fact of life that women, only women, can make a house a home. Men can't do that. And so for a long time, I lived in a house again. And it's the pits. And then I'm talking at an old-timers meeting. And this guy comes up to me. He says, "Would you like to meet somebody?" I said, "Is it a woman?" And he introduced me to Marilyn. And I'm an ex-cop. And I got her number fast. And I called Marilyn. And we started dating. And on the 14th of June, 2009, Marilyn and I got married. Isn't that wonderful? And she's real active in Al-Anon, and I'm very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we got a good thing going. We got a good thing going. But I got to tell you about, on the first day I went back to that clubhouse that these guys were at, and I walked in the clubhouse that day and there's no meetings going on. Just two old goats sitting over here in a round table playing cribbage. And I walk in the door like over there. And they walk in the door and they stop playing cribbage. And one of them poked the other one and says, "We better do something with that one. Or he's going to start jackknifing around the room here, you know." I mean, I wasn't nervous, just quick, you know. And they applied the only therapy they knew at that time. They gave me a bucket of paint and a paintbrush, figuring that I could paint faster than anybody else in the place. I painted that damn clubhouse, and I can't tell you to this day how long I painted. I don't know if I painted 5 days, 50 days. I don't think it means a heck of a lot. But I'll never forget the day I finished. It was a bright Saturday morning. Put away the buckets and the brushes, cleaned everything else up just perfect. Because we're perfectionists too, you know. Then they found out the truth, that one of them cribbage players had been a painter all his life. And the old thinking came back that fast. Why me, God? Why wasn't he up there painting? And I'll fix their clocks. I'll get drunk at every damn one of them. And it was this clubhouse was renting space above a liquor store and a laundry in Glendale. And I headed for the back door and reached for the push bar in the black back door of the clubhouse. You know what? And the door opened up ahead of me. And there's this clown standing on a little landing out there. He has a smile from ear to ear. And he says, "Hi." And I said, "Shove it." He says, "Why do you say that to me? I don't even know you." I said, "Shove it anyhow." He said, "Come here, I'll talk to you." Set me down in them Henroyd chairs, not these nice padded ones. Them cold metal ones. And I told him about them gray-haired goats, and they made me paint that club, and I'm going to get drunk at every one of them. And he ended up being my sponsor. He said, "If I'm going to be your sponsor, three things are going to happen to you, man. One, you're going to study that book. Two, you're going to talk it over with me. And three, you're going to learn to follow instructions. I thought, how the heck does he know that? And they say at that time in Los Angeles, there was 700 meetings a week in the greater Los Angeles area. And today there's 3,200 a week. And we made them all. Yeah. I mean, it was meetings every night. And newcomers is going to happen to you, because don't feel bad about it. You're going to say to your wife, your husband, your buddy, your girlfriend, meetings every night. Tonight I'm not going. And that night he came by early. Put me in the car, started down the freeway. I said, where are we going tonight? And he's crusty. Yeah. He says, we're going to the hole in the ground. I thought, oh my God, now they're going to bury me. For those of you who don't know where the hole in the ground is or was, it was underneath the E-Bell Club in Huntington Park, California. It was started by a guy by the name of Tex Adams, who had been sober since Lincoln had the measles. And thank God for people like Tex who started places like that for drunks like me. And he told me I had to study this book. And we're going down the steps, and I tapped him on the shoulder. I said, Joe, I got to ask you something. And I told you, he's crusty. He turned around, looked at me like this, and he says, yeah, what do you want now? And I very meekly said, how long do I have to go to these damn meetings? And he got fighting mad that fast. Took his index finger, shoved me into the corner so they wouldn't hear it inside. When he got me in the corner where I couldn't get away, he started to get violent. Yeah. He started to hit me in the chest like this with his finger. And he started screaming. He said, you idiot. I didn't like that. He says, you have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings. Then you don't have to go to meetings anymore. Doesn't make much sense then, but it sure does now. And them old-timers, you know, they're smart. They set you here in the front row so you don't nod off, right, honey? And I'm sitting there, and I'm really ticked, you know? Making a fool out of me, screaming at me and hollering at me. And I'm going to flip out. I just knew it. I'm going to flip out. And I can't tell you this, but how this, it all had to come out from some bigger authority than all of us. There, I'm going to split, you know. There's this guy, he's sitting on a piece of paper there, scribbling on a piece of paper. I thought, I didn't know you had to take notes here. And I watch him. And all of a sudden, he takes this piece of paper, heads for the door, put it on the bulletin board like you have back there, stuck it on the bulletin board, and split. And I'm an ex-cop, and I'm nosy by nature. And I got to find out what's on that slip of paper, right? So I sneak over to the bulletin board. Don't tell me there's no miracles. Because you know what was on that piece of paper? It was a little poem about drunks. And I read it, and it made sense. And when nobody was looking, I stole it. Took it along home. And on the days when I was absolutely certain that I just can't make this thing, you know, it might be all right for you guys, but I just can't make it. And yet, I didn't want to go back out there in the damn cold cars and start drinking rot-gut wine again. So I read it and saved it a long time. And it's getting that time, about that time. It's a little poem entitled, Which Place? I dreamed one night I passed away and left this world behind. Started down that lonesome trail, some of my friends to find. Came to a signboard on the trail, directions it did tell. Keep right to go to heaven, turn left to go to hell. I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless, boozing rake. And knew there at the crossroads the path I'd have to take. So I started on a rocky path that leads to Satan's place. And shook within, not knowing just what I'd have to face. Old Satan met me at the gate, what's your name, my friend? I said, I'm just old sober Sam that's come to a sad end. He glanced through some files. You made a mistake, I fear. You're listed as an alcoholic. We don't want you here. I said, I'm looking for my friends. And a smile stole over his face. if your friends are alcoholic, they're in the other place. So I went back the other way till the crossroads I did see and turned right to heaven, as happy as could be. St. Peter smiled and said, "Come in, for you I have a berth. You're an alcoholic. You've been through hell on earth." I saw old Dub and old Pete too, Bill C. and a friend called Bell. And brother, I was tickled because I thought they'd gone to hell. So brothers, I'll take warning, learn something from my trip. You got a place in heaven if you try hard not to slip. If someone tempts you with a drink when you're not feeling well, just tell him you're going to heaven and he can go to hell.